From Lakeshore Public Radio, this is Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. The National Data Book, as it's called, which is a 50-state report on the recent household data that's been developed by the Annie Casey Foundation, has come out about how families are dealing with matters of very, very great importance between the Great Recession and the beginning of the COVID-19 crisis. Well, where did Indiana stand in the latest ranking? That's why we turn to Tammy Silverman, who's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. And Tammy, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Always my pleasure. Happy to be with you, Chris.
Well, I know we have some very interesting facts that have come out in some of the surveys putting the National Data Book together. And we usually focus in on the Indiana Data Book, but we have the whole country to deal with and how, I guess, Indiana was broken out of the report. Where did Indiana stand on this report, and particularly as we're trying to come out of the pandemic?
Right. And so you're absolutely right. So this National Data Book allows us to look at Indiana as compared to the rest of the country. And this year, Indiana ranks 29th in the nation for overall child well-being. And we'll get to how that breaks down in a couple. You know, they really look at it in four different buckets or domains. But overall, we were 29th, which is pretty close to where we've been the last several years.
Are we finding that this book is the most important in many because it is giving us an idea of how we can try to come back to, I guess, what would be best called a pre-pandemic level of support for youngsters and for families?
Yes, you know, you're absolutely right. It's great that we're diving deep into this. Now, we know that a lot of the data that is reflected in this year's National Kids Count Data Book is pre-COVID. That being said, we're starting to get some of that information. Obviously, we're hearing from the youth services field and education field as to what those things, and we're starting to predict what might happen with the data. And so that, you know, at the end of the day, all the data is geared towards helping kids and communities and families. So we're really trying to lean in and also compare it to the recession and say, is this similar to or different from some of the challenges that we faced in the past?
Do we find that many of the challenges still existing are ones that seem to deal with racial and ethnic disparities?
Absolutely. You know, again, if we talk about being 29th overall, when we start to dig into many of these well-being indicators, when you disaggregate that data, particularly by race, we see very clearly that Black, Hispanic, Latino families and kids in our state are facing much larger hurdles.
Let's go into those four domains, and I'll let you start it out here and talk about in more depth the issues that the Annie Casey Foundation put together for this year's National Data Book, dealing first with economic well-being.
Absolutely. Well, when we're talking about economic well-being, that's been a bit of a bright spot for Indiana. So we ranked 18th nationally there. So obviously that's higher than our 29th overall. And what we're talking about there is the percentage of kids living in poverty, kids in families where the parent doesn't have full-time year-round employment, the number of kids that are those kind of older teens that may be not attending school, not working, and households that have a high housing burden. So it's an assessment of a whole bunch of different factors. We did fall this year. We previously had been 15th, and we fell to 18th. And again, we know that, again, employment's going to be impacted by COVID-19 and those household income rates and the housing rates could also show a decline next year. We're fairly concerned about those.
I know we mostly focus on very young people going into preschool and into the elementary grades. How about teenagers? Where do they show in the statistics as to those who didn't go to school and are not working and how they fit in the report?
You know, they stayed fairly close. It's a great question. So we do pay attention to teens ages 16 to 19 who are not attending school and not working. And that went up by 1% to 7%. Again, it's going to be really interesting. We need to pay close attention to that coming out of the pandemic to make sure that we don't have a bunch of kids that are kind of getting lost and that we have ways to engage them either in the workforce or in post-secondary education.
Now, we spend a lot of time talking about education and the impact on young people, the coronavirus pandemic in particular, the impact with youngsters, the preschoolers, and what kind of impact on their early learning is going to face, and then, of course, those young people that have had to go to school remotely here. What did the Annie Casey Foundation report nationally show for education as far as the ranking for Indiana is concerned?
Yes, this was our number one ranking. We were ranked 17th in the country. So that's a bit of a bright spot, right? That's something that we like to see. That being said, we still, you know, when you talk about the number of fourth graders who are at the proficient reading level and the number of eighth graders who are at the proficient math levels, again, those were 12th and 13th in the country if we're diving into the data. But that still means that there's a good number of kids who aren't proficient at reading and who aren't proficient at math. And so we need to keep driving for better results so that we make sure that our kids have the support they need.
What does the national data book show for health of Hoosier youngsters in the book?
Yes. Well, unfortunately, health is our lowest ranking, and that continues to be a challenge. You know, we have a lot of kids who, you know, our child and teen death rates improved a little bit, but at the same time, we also are looking at infant mortality rates and low birth weights. We also know that proportionate to other states, we have a higher number of kids who are overweight or obese. And we're, again, if we're thinking about coming out of the pandemic, we're fairly concerned about that because we know that kids they weren't able to get out and they weren't as able to participate in sports and activities and some of those things that keep them moving and healthy.
Now, looking at the last metric, I guess, as far as the national book is concerned and how Indiana fared in it, is about family and community context. Will you tell us what the foundation showed in the national data book and how Indiana fits in?
Yes, there we were 31st, and I know there's, you know, we're throwing around a whole bunch of rankings, but again, that's a little worse than our overall ranking, and so that means that we have more so than the national average, a number of kids living in high poverty areas. Teen birth rates actually were worse this past year than in the past. Kids living in families where no one in the house had a high school diploma are some of the factors that go into that. And so it's really important that, again, that kids, you know, kids who live in a economically stable household and community have the ability to reach their full potential more so than kids that are facing a lot of struggles.
How does the ranking show as far as adults with youngsters in the household, as far as health insurance is concerned? I know a lot of this deals primarily as well with economic well-being, but how did the breakout show, and especially coming out of the pandemic now?
You know, again, we do have a decent number of kids that are families that have health insurance. That being said, our rate's pretty high, but the reality is other, you know, children without health insurance is just 7.1%, so less than 8%. That mm-hmm. being said, that still puts us 38th in the country. Most other states have more children enrolled in health insurance, which kids that have health insurance are more likely to get preventative care, and that can be vaccines and checkups and all of those things that help keep them healthy rather than having it to have to be an acute health issue that's being dealt with and treated.
Did we see in Indiana, based on the data that the Indiana Youth Institute has been working with from the Annie Casey Foundation, about households that have someone who maybe wants to go on to college or some kind of post-secondary education, whatever it may be, whether it's job training, whether it's community college, whatever it may be? Are we seeing any changes from the report this time around?
Yes. So in 2020, we knew that 41% of households that had someone planning to enroll in post-secondary education changed their plans. So think about that. Someone in that house was planning to enroll and they changed their plans, most often because they needed to work or support their family. Someone had lost a job due to COVID or had gotten ill and couldn't work. And so again, that increased again just this past March to 42%. But we're, and 42% doesn't sound like a big deal. However, Indiana is one of only four states to see that go up.
Oh.
And so we really need to make sure that individuals that are prepared and want to go to post-secondary education have a way to do so.
And I know that the Annie Casey Foundation has spent time, of course, I'm sure that you've had in looking at the national report and where Indiana fits in the breakout, on the issue of policy, how we're dealing with the issues that the data has shown. What does it look like as far as the Indiana Youth Institute is concerned with what you get to do with your outreach to lawmakers when it's time for them to come back to Indianapolis for the General Assembly session and things they can help change? What are they showing based on the information that the Annie Casey Foundation is talking about and how policy can be shaped now as we're coming out of the pandemic and some of the things that they're having to deal with from the Indiana standpoint in the book?
Yes. Well, one of the most encouraging ones is the child tax credit, and folks are seeing that coming right now, and they're getting the notices, and they'll start to get that tax credit.
That's right. There is
sweeping bipartisan support to make this permanent, and that's both at the federal and at the state level. And so we hope that that makes sure that, you know, that it is permanent. It's not just a one-time recovery issue, but that it's something permanent. And if that were to become permanent, it could be, we could end up with one of the largest drops in child poverty that we've seen in just years and years. So that's probably one of the biggest points of encouragement. We know that our state also has passed a lot of, you know, and is offering a lot of funds to help with summer learning loss, and that will continue through the next year. And that, again, is very encouraging.
How about trying to help families and communities of color? Is there anything in there that the IYI can talk to lawmakers about, lobby for them in trying to make improvements?
You bet. Now, I am required to say we don't lobby. However,
right, yeah,
there is a lot of information and education that we share on In and Out all the time, daily basis, because, again, the data is very, very clear. When you disaggregate pretty much any of these indicators by race, we know that there are systems and our history does not afford the same opportunity to kids and families of color. So we need to be leaning in and saying, how do we correct that? How do we structure things differently so that we ensure that every child of color and every child in Indiana can reach their full potential? So yes, we're doing that. You know, I don't know if quite on a daily basis, but certainly on a weekly basis. Well,
I should mention, yeah, but you don't lobby, but you'd certainly advocate and get public support. And hopefully citizens that are very concerned about these issues ought to be out there and talking with their own representative or their own state senator about some of these issues and shape their ideas and their thoughts. And maybe that will turn into some bills that will be put into the hopper for the next General Assembly session, to be sure. Now, we put an awful lot out today. There's a lot to consider. And I'm sure people that have heard our conversation will want to know more. Where can citizens in Indiana in particular find out more about the results in the National Kids Count Data Book and what they should do to find out if they want to get to some more local issues?
Absolutely. So there's a couple of places. You can go to IYI.org and you can access both the national data book there as well as Indiana's, as well as your county snapshot. So we can go national, state, and local there. If you want to go straight to Annie Casey, as we said, they're one of our great partners. That is, their website is aecf.org, so either aecf.org or iyi.org.
Well, Tammy, thank you for being with us to bring up all the data and all the impact that the National Kids Count Data Book has put out and where Indiana ranks in the standings. We appreciate you being with us today.
Always my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Tammy Silverman. She's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Indiana's food banks, including the one in Northwest Indiana, are due to reportedly receive some much-needed federal funding. And we find out more in this from reporter Suzanne Potter.
Food banks across Indiana are prepping to make good use of $1 million in funding over the next fiscal year, money that starts rolling in mid-July. The legislature upped the funding from $300,000 per year after hunger shot through the roof during the pandemic. Emily Weichert Bryant with Feeding Indiana's Hungry says millions of people nationwide are still struggling.
We know for the month of April that the need and the pounds being distributed was about 45% above what an average month would have been in 2019. So we're still seeing above average demand. We're still helping folks who are still working to make ends meet.
Weichert says during the lockdowns, cars snaked around the block at many food banks as people picked up pre-boxed food. And many food banks had to rent cold storage to keep their perishable donations safe and even buy food outright to meet the demand. Jennifer Buell with the Terre Haute Catholic Charities Food Bank says they saw a 16% increase in clientele in 2020 compared with the year before, and they estimate that 25% of the children within their service area are food insecure day after day.
Over and over and over again, And for children, that's affecting both their physical and their cognitive development. And those delays that you see in childhood because of food insecurity can actually last an entire lifetime.
Advocates say the increased funding will help food banks modernize and expand their facilities so they can continue to combat hunger in Indiana. For Indiana News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Lake County Council members got a chance to hear for the first time a bit more about the new wetlands law that is now in effect in Indiana. In fact, it's a measure that even a person on the General Assembly voted for it, called it controversial, and it certainly has turned out that way. Many of the state's environmentalists and Democrats spoke out against the bill all through this past General Assembly session, and some have also pleaded with Governor Holcomb to veto it, or not sign it at least. That wasn't the case. It's now law. And now Lake County Surveyor Bill Emerson has a chance to tell us more about the measure and what kind of impact it's going to have locally. Bill, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me. I'm really glad you invited me on. Wetlands are so important for the state and for flood control, for water quality, for habitat. Wetlands cover really 4% of the state, and they account for 50% of the habitat for animals in the state. So they're very important. And locally, I was disappointed in the law that was passed, removing protection for about 50% of the wetlands in the state, mostly isolated wetlands. So I'm working with our drainage board and our council to see what we can do about protecting wetlands here locally.
Mm-hmm. I understand from what I've heard about the measure, it was described that these wetlands that come under the measure are ones that are described like isolated, as you mentioned. They're out in maybe open countryside. How many of those would you guess, are in Lake County?
Well, we're actually looking at that now. I don't have an exact number on that. A lot of the wetlands we deal with along waterways would still be protected federally and through the state. But yeah, you're right. So the isolated wetlands are a little harder to quantify a lot of times, and it's kind of a case-by-case basis when folks want to develop a property or, in some cases, ask to just fill in a wetland for whatever reason. That's when they kind of come to the foreground when we look at them, especially in unincorporated areas that we have authority over under the Lake County Plan Commission.
Mm-hmm. Are there any in particular that come to mind that you know that there are wetlands out there that maybe kind of under this category that you'll have to keep a closer eye on because of the way that the law has now changed, that they can be covered over, filled in, developed over?
Well, off the top of my head, not really. I mean, yeah. That's kind of the problem when they're isolated. They could be, in the back corner of a kind of an agricultural area. That you may not even notice it. It may not be really causing anyone any issues, or you may not even know it's there. But once that property wants to be developed, or somebody wants to develop that property, they may want to just fill it in. And in the past, we'd have ways to have that property owner, they call it mitigate
yeah.
that impact, or to create a wetland in another area. But right now, the way the law is statewide, that doesn't seem to be a possibility. So we're looking at ways locally that we can kind of help preserve the natural environment here in Lake County.
Well, you mentioned here at the outset of the conversation about the fact that you're going to have to spend a lot of time looking deeper into these issues, and since they're kind of isolated all over the county, I suppose, that you'll have to be able to present something to the drainage board eventually so that they can take care of this matter.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's what we're in the process of doing now. And that was sort of my request to the lawmakers earlier in the session, was to kind of take a breath and take a step back,
yeah.
and kind of look at what we're doing here, because a lot of these wetland areas, took millions of years to develop and into what they are right now, and they're so important for water quality, and like I said, for habitat and flood control, that I hated to see with one short session here, all that undone, but that argument wasn't persuasive down there.
Now, we know, of course, from history of what's happened, for example, along the Kankakee River. It used to be a much, much wider, much more expansive wetlands many, many, many decades ago. But unfortunately, over the 20th century, they got cleared away. And that's we're kind of left with what we have now, trying to do the best we can in protecting like that whole area there along the Kankakee River, the marshes all around it.
That's exactly right. And it's ironic that now we're spending a lot of money trying to restore a lot of that area because of the flood control benefits and the natural habitat benefits because of, 100 years ago those were drained and many were filled in. So we're spending public money now to reestablish those areas. And so I feel like we're kind of taking a step back here with the isolated wetland law. But, we're gonna do our best locally, and that's all we can do.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any other ideas maybe that have been talked about with your colleagues, other county surveyors and other officials in other counties, in particular ones along the Kankakee River, just for an example, like in Porter County and points to the east, to try to deal with issues that are going to come up? And I'm sure that this had this ongoing discussion probably while the General Assembly was taking a look at this measure.
Yeah, and really the wetlands along the Kankakee would not be really impacted a whole lot by this law because they're at the waters of the U.S. and the federal, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and EPA regulate those wetlands already. So that wouldn't be a huge impact. This law doesn't really impact the Kankakee that much. But there's always ongoing discussions with the Kankakee Commission on, improving the wetlands and also improving flow. So it's kind of a balancing act. You want to store water, and you also want to keep the water moving. So,
I know that you've had an opportunity here to take a look at some of the projects that are underway. In fact, I'm sure that it's probably been in the planning stages on some of the work that you'd like to be able to do or have contractors do along the Kankakee River. And you've asked for some funds to be able to go towards that. Can you tell us what you would like to be able to do, at least on your part, as the Lake County Surveyor?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. So, there's a lot of woody debris in the river right now. Excuse me, and those that wood and trees get jammed up in crossings and railroad crossings and things like that. So one of the things we're doing is kind of removing a lot of that woody debris, and also it's gotten so bad that in some areas you can't get a boat down very easily without hitting trees and things. So that's one of the main things we want to do, and also keeping sediment out of the river is important because when the river was dredged in early part of the last century, it was just dredged to the state line and then was left natural in Illinois, and so a lot of the sediment from Indiana just drops out right here at the state line and right over the state line in Illinois. So keeping sediment out of the river is important as well. So we're doing some great work on the Yellow River, which leads into the Kankakee, which is a really sandy. Name the Yellow River because it is so sandy and yellow and brings a lot of sediment into the system. So we're doing some work, bank stabilization, things like that, on the Yellow River to make sure that sediment stays out of the river.
Mm-hmm. How much of this are you going to be able to do while the weather's still nice here during 2021?
We have a project right now at the Grand Kankakee Marsh in Lake County that we're going to get started here in the next, hopefully, month or so with the water being down and into the summer, bank stabilization project. So it is important to make sure you work with the weather and you don't get when the river's down to do a lot of this work.
So. Right. I imagine you worry about what's going to happen during flooding time. It's going to happen. It happens every spring, it seems, and every fall, after the snows that we usually get melt away and fill up certainly there on the marshes and in turn going into the Kankakee River.
Absolutely. And we've been lucky from that perspective. This year it's been historically dry. Spring, so we haven't had issues that we've had in the past. And 2018 in February was just a historic event that really got a lot of the updates to the Kankakee River Commission started. And so we've had a lot of really early spring rain events that have kind of overwhelmed a lot of areas. So we've been lucky that way this year.
And I know that the comments that were mentioned here, certainly from State Representative Niemeyer, who I guess had a chance to talk with the Lake County Council about the measures that came up during the General Assembly session. This one, the wetlands bill in particular, probably the council hasn't had a lot of chance to respond to what they probably heard that day.
That's true. And I'm not sure if they will or if that's going to be kind of a work in progress. And I know there are folks that Senator Niemeyer represents that did have some issues, you know, especially the agricultural community, with maintaining their fields and wet areas, and there were some legitimate concerns on that end as well. It was just, I guess, like I said, my hope that they would have kind of put it on the back burner, looked at it a little closer over the summer here, but that wasn't the case.
Slate County Surveyor Bill Emerson Jr. talking about a recent discussion before the Lake County Council about the new wetlands measure and the concern that the environmentalists as well as farmers may have about what's been passed by the General Assembly. And Bill, thank you very much for spending time talking about it with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Everything from Lego figures, chimpanzees, even pizza have successfully made it into space. But Purdue University researchers are trying to crack a mystery that has long plagued NASA, how to make a refrigerator work in zero gravity. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Ben Thorpe tells us, some NASA officials say that cold food storage is one of the biggest hurdles for long-term space missions.
In a lab on the campus of Purdue University, researcher Leon Brendel pulls the pin out of a refrigerator that has been elevated on a big metal frame. Now, he's able to spin the refrigerator, even tipping it upside down.
There are some loose objects in here.
The goal here is to test how the refrigeration system works when spun around on Earth, a crude approximation of what it would be like to have a fridge in space, where there is no up, down, or sideways. Brendel says since at least the 1980s, NASA has made several attempts to get a fridge system similar to those used on Earth working in space, with varying levels of success. One effort in the 2000s was sent to the International Space Station and failed soon after being turned on in zero gravity.
That was a very unsuccessful project. In the meantime, that thing has been literally tossed overboard of the International Space Station because it just did not provide any cooling.
There are some options for keeping things cool on the space station, but those are largely used for scientific experiments and aren't efficient enough for keeping food frozen on long missions. What makes Earth-bound refrigerators hard to translate to space is their use of oil as a lubricant. That oil relies on gravity to keep it where it needs to be. Stephen Kasky is an engineer with Air Squared, Purdue's industry partner on the research project.
And that's normally why this black-looking device, this mechanical-looking device, is at the bottom of your fridge so that it helps, gravity helps keep oil in that compressor. This is part of that orientation dependence.
The fridge developed by Purdue and Air Squared is oil-free and has been designed with an eye towards energy efficiency. In order to test their fridge system, Leon Brendel and Purdue professor Eckhard Grohl took their fridge onto a plane that performed parabolas, flying up and suddenly dropping over 3 miles in about 20 seconds, approximating a zero-gravity environment. Professor Grohl says they had to use those brief moments to see how their fridge system reacted to zero gravity.
We're taking all these measurements, doing zero gravity. Does it still perform the way it's supposed to be when it's at zero gravity, right? What changes can we observe and what do we need to watch out for?
In videos of the test, the Purdue team scrambles to take measurements during the 20-second freefall while everything around them begins to float.
I threw up.
Grohl says the team is still analyzing the data from those tests, but their fridge shows promise.
We were trying to find stable operating conditions that are basically have zero, where the gravity has zero impact, right? That's what we ultimately wanted to prove.
All of this is important because right now astronauts rely primarily on shelf-stable food, dry goods, or canned foods, which last somewhere between 1 and 3 years. That's long enough for trips to the moon or stints on the space station, where they can receive regular resupplies, but not nearly long enough for a trip to Mars.
Refrigeration takes a lot of resources in a very resource-restricted environment.
This is Dr. Grace Douglas, the lead scientist of advanced food technology for NASA.
And refrigeration could increase the shelf life for some foods and some nutrients, And we're trying to figure out exactly how long that could be right now, because we really want a 5-year shelf life.
Douglas also says, especially on long missions, food is important not only for nutrition, but also because it can be an astronaut's connection back to Earth.
As Earth becomes smaller and smaller and they don't have that beautiful Earth view, having food that they can choose from that's familiar, that is one of the only things sometimes that can provide that familiarity to Earth and something that's like a comfort.
If the parabolic experiments show that the fridge system worked well, researchers say the next step will be a long-term test of the fridge on the International Space Station. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Ben Thorpe.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.